States v. Bergdahl. Mr. Fidel, are you ready to argue?
I am, Your Honor.
Please proceed.
Chief Judge Stuckey, and may it please the court, may I reserve 5 minutes?
5 minutes is reserved. Granted.
I've been involved with military justice for over 50 years. I've studied it closely, I've written about it, and I've taught it. In my opinion, this is the most important case ever to have come before this court. No, this is not a capital case. In fact, it's a case that could only even be here because it involves a punitive discharge. It's also a case that should never have been brought given the longstanding policy against charging returned POWs for anything other than offenses committed in captivity. What makes this case important is that it goes to the heart of this court's role as a bulwark against unlawful influence, a vice long recognized as the immortal enemy of military justice. I should say immortal enemy of military justice. This court has seen many cases that have sounded in UCI. It has even seen one, Kelly, that involved the president. But it has never seen one in which both the Commander-in-Chief and the Chair of the Senate Armed Services Committee cast such a dark shadow over the administration of justice. Never before has a holder of either of those two high offices chosen to target a specific soldier facing specific charges, as the President and the late Senator McCain have done in the case of Sergeant Bo Bergdahl. I want to stress 3 points. First, the government has the burden of proving beyond a reasonable doubt that a disinterested objective observer fully informed of the facts and circumstances would not harbor a significant doubt as to the fairness of the process, and that an undue strain has not been placed on the military justice system. The government has not carried that burden. The taint with which Senator McCain and the President infected this case is both intolerable and indelible. Second, elected officials will continue to meddle in court-martial for political reasons unless this court sends a message that is firm enough to achieve deterrence. Court-martial must never again be a plaything to politicians. Third, the remedy must fit the violation. Here, the UCI is intentional, accused-specific, malevolent, uncured, and emanating from the highest levels. Senator McCain was warned by the Army and the staff general counsel not to meddle. The President was put on notice by one of the military judges' rulings. His advisors were in direct contact with trial counsel about UCI, and the sham statement on military justice was issued by his press office. Nonetheless, on they went, Senator McCain and the President, indifferent to the damage they were doing to public confidence in the military justice system. The charges should be dismissed with prejudice.
Thank you, Mr. Fidel. And I will go first. My initial question has to do with Senator McCain. Senator McCain made two statements. One was what was essentially a criticism of foreign policy. I wouldn't have cut this deal to trade these bad guys for Bergdahl. The other was a statement that if Bergdahl got a sentence of no punishment, the SAS would hold a hearing. With respect to the first statement, that's nothing more than a criticism of foreign policy. It says nothing about any potential punishment or disciplinary action. It's simply a criticism of foreign policy. They made a bad deal. With respect to the second point, Senator McCain did nothing more, than, it seems to me, than state that the committee would exercise its constitutional responsibility of oversight over the military justice system. Holding a hearing is a legitimate way of doing that. It may not be pleasant if you are the person testifying at the hearing, but how are either of those unlawful influence?
Thank you, Chief Judge. First of all, Senator McCain's involvement went beyond the two items that you mentioned. As the record indicates, thanks to the Freedom of Information Act and other discovery that we obtained, there was a continuing fire of emails and phone calls back and forth between the Army and his staff. Senator McCain wanted to make statements. He was told not to meddle in this case. The Army said, we'll do a curative statement for you. The staff and the senator never took the Army up on that. Senator McCain called Sergeant Birdall a deserter before any charges had been brought. And the idea that there was no chilling effect as a result, or that a disinterested objective observer would not be concerned about the fact that Senator McCain threatened to hold a hearing if Sergeant Birdall weren't punished, I think that's quite clear, Your Honor, that that is as much unlawful congressional influence as has ever happened. That is the threat to have an unpleasant exercise in case the outcome of this particular proceeding wasn't to his satisfaction, and that is intolerable.
Thank you. Judge Raya.
Yeah, Mr. Fidel, I have two questions to ask you. One is your brief, and today you've repeatedly noted or asserted that there's this policy for returning POWs, that they won't be charged or tried except for things that they did while they were POWs. So one question I have is, where do I find that policy, or what are you relying on when you say it? And then the second question I have is, with respect to Senator McCain, is your argument that his meddling via the staff affected the determination to send it to a general court-martial that could adjudge a dishonorable discharge and meaningful punishment, or is it something else?
Good morning, Your Honor. May I take those in reverse order?
Sure.
This is an apparent UCI case, so the only question is whether there is a relevance, a kind of nexus between what we're complaining about and the administration of justice. So we don't have to show that it actually had any particular effect. That's the part of the forest we're in, and I think that is the most direct answer to your second question. As to the first question, we have relied extensively and for a long time in this litigation on the official Office of the Secretary of Defense history of the Vietnam War with respect to POWs. And this is, I think, a book called The Long Road Home. It's cited in our brief. The government has never contested in any way our submission on this. They said, well, if that policy doesn't apply, this is like other cases, but they've never quarreled in any way with our assertion. I'm holding in my hand a scene of the, this would be from the, say what, ma'am?
No, so with respect to the second question that I answered first, and I understand that this is an apparent UCI case, but don't you still have to say that it would appear to a member of the general public that the meddling via the staff had some result?
No, it doesn't, Your Honor. All it has to do is raise a question in the mind of a reasonable disinterested observer, aware, fully informed of all the facts and circumstances, and to consider that a threat of a congressional hearing made before the main event in the litigation will result, if the outcome isn't to the liking of a particular member of the Senate, in fact, a senior member of the Senate, will lead to a hearing at which people whose futures, professional futures, will be subject to potential adverse effects through the confirmation process. That's enough of a connection. Remember, the court has repeatedly said that the threshold is a low threshold, and we handily meet that.
Thank you, Mr. Fidel. Judge Olson.
Good morning, Mr. Fidel. I just want to follow up on the question that was posed by Judge Ryan in regard to the prosecution of returning POWs. I'm curious about how you view the court-martial of Sergeant Charles Robert Jenkins fitting into your argument. Jenkins was stationed with U.S. Army in South Korea. He walked across the DMZ into North Korea. He said he was starved, beaten, and mentally tortured over years. But then when the Army got its hands on Sergeant Jenkins in 2004, they court-martialed him for desertion, and he was sentenced to a dishonorable discharge and 30 days in prison. I'm just wondering, under that scenario, should an objective, disinterested observer conclude that Sergeant Jenkins and Sergeant Bergdahl were similarly situated and were treated in a similar manner?
Thank you very much, Your Honor. To respond both to your question, Your Honor, and the first of Judge Ryan's questions, there is an information paper prepared by Colonel Dick Jackson, which is page A-219, which I think was an attachment to the investigation in the state. Paints that you're referring to, Your Honor, I don't think it's in the record, but let's not stop at that point. The fact is that the individual that you're referring to seems to have been a defector rather than a deserter. There is a difference. And in addition, he was a person who had actively collaborated with the North Korean authorities. He lived the life of Riley in North Korea. He made propaganda videos for North Korea. I think the two cases are entirely dissimilar.
Okay. If I still have any time left, Chief, could I ask
you? You do.
So Senator McCain began rattling his sword against Sergeant Bergdahl in a political article in June 2014. From the perspective of an objective, disinterested observer, what should they make of the fact that the Army didn't seem too spooked by that because it took them 10 months to prefer charges against Sergeant Bergdahl?
Well, thank you, Your Honor. First of all, Rome wasn't built in a day, and it does take time, even for the Army to move. It's like moving an aircraft carrier, I imagine, at times. But the passage of time, I think, is not the point. If you look at the timeline, Your Honor, that was attached to our main brief, there was a constant interaction between the Senate Armed Services Committee's General Counsel and the Army's Congressional and Legislative Liaison. They wanted to know everything. When was there going to be an announcement? What was happening? Give us a briefing. This is the kind of micromanagement. That's fine if you're talking about the budget. It's not fine when you're talking about the administration of justice in a particular case. Congress hasn't been involved in the retail administration of justice since the Articles of Confederation.
Thank you, Mr. Fidel. Judge Sparks.
Thank you, Chief Judge. Good morning, Mr. Fidel.
Good morning, Your Honor.
Mr. Fidel, I want to ask about the lower court's dissenting judge in his opinion. And in his opinion, he suggested that the appropriate remedy in this case might be simply disapproval or reversal of the dishonorable discharge. In your brief, you seem to think that, at least gives the impression that you do not believe that to be a sufficient remedy. Can you explain why you don't see the dissenting judge's proposed resolution of, at least from his point of view, as a sufficient remedy in this case, should the court find in your favor?
Right, Your Honor. The answer to that question requires an appreciation of the various aspects of UCI that we chronicled in the case. All Judge Ewing we were grateful for his dissent. It was a partial dissent. All Judge Ewing thought merited that relief, that namely disapproving the punitive discharge, was the statement of President Trump faulting the military judge, saying that was a complete and total disgrace to for the nation and for the military. Judge Ewing went along with the majority on a host of other aspects, such as the statement that President Trump made in the Rose Garden, ratifying all of his pre-inaugural comments. Judge Ewing, like the majority, thought there was nothing wrong and used the item with anything Senator McCain had said or done. Judge Ewing did not address the traitor tweet about which we complained while the appeal was pending. My point is that Judge Ewing, in our view, did not take into full account all of the other elements of unlawful command influence to which we referred. As a result, the basis on which he calculated what relief should be accorded was incomplete. And in our view, both whether you accept his position or you accept the majority's position, there are errors in their both rejection of our claims, whether at the threshold or on the theory that the government actually carried its burden of proof. The consequence is that you have to rewrite the balance for what is cumulative in this record. And only once you have a lodestar, a baseline for all of the UCI, can you then evaluate, whether from the majority's perspective or Judge Ewing's more generous perspective, what relief should be granted. So that's a long-winded answer to your question, Your Honor.
No, I appreciate it. Chief Judge, I have nothing further.
Judge Maggs.
Yes, good morning, Mr. Fidel.
Good morning, Your Honor.
I have three questions that concern rule for court-martial 104A1. This is the rule, of course, that says that no convening authority or commander can censure or reprimand the court-martial. Obviously, the language in RCM 104A1 is different from that in Article 37A. But my first question is, shouldn't we find that the words "in this case" or something to that effect are implied in RCM 104A1 such that it would be no convening authority or commander in this case or concerning this case, as opposed to no convening authority or commander anywhere?
No, Your Honor, and the answer is there are two reasons for that. The first is that the Army Court sided with us on that issue, and the government did not cross-petition or cross-certify the case. Therefore, the law of the case governs that. The court, I think, is barred by standing jurisprudence from embracing a position that the government did not advance, did not take up here. The second thing is that the text of Rule RCM 4A1, that is the operative document. That's what's in the executive order, and I don't think it would be respectful of the executive authority, the president as commander-in-chief, and under Rule Article 36, to read words in simply unfair. And in fact, the rule has morphed over time, and since 1968 or 69, it has not been limited to cases in which the offending official is the convening authority.
Thank you. My second question is, does the president have authority to create in RCM 104A1 a rule that's different from the rule in Article 37A? In other words, does he have the authority to create a broader rule?
I seem to recall an article that deals at great length. There are actually two articles that deal with the subject of the president's power under Article 36, and I think the authors of those are the individuals that are having this conversation right now. In my opinion, the president's authority as commander-in-chief and under Article 36 is broad enough that he can impose a requirement in addition to or more restrictive than the provision that in Article 37. Nothing prevents Congress from conferring greater rights, for example, than the Constitution requires, and nothing prevents the president as commander-in-chief and under Article 36 from providing greater protection than the statute provides.
Okay, and my last question, if I have time, concerns the Boyd case.
You don't have time.
Oh,
and Mr. Fidel may continue to argue, and now any judge may jump in with any question he has, and of course that includes you, Judge May.
Thank you, Chief Judge. I think this is a case that provides the court a very welcome opportunity to state some neutral principles for relief in UCI cases. Here's my catalog. The relief should be meaningful. It should reflect the totality of the circumstances. It should be proportional to the UCI. For example, it should take into account whether the UCI is egregious or whether it has the capacity to do catastrophic mischief. That's from the Chicago case in the Navy Court. It should take into account the seniority of the actors. You could have, for example, a presumption of dismissal with prejudice any time there's presidential UCI for obvious reasons.
Counsel, can I interrupt you for a moment?
Of course.
So with respect to the last piece that you complained of, which is the president's comment about the sentence that was received, I just wonder how you respond to these points, which is, one, your client specifically asked for a dishonorable discharge and acknowledged that he understood everything that came along with it. In his post-trial matters, he did not request clemency in terms of a sentence reduction, and he also did not avail himself of the opportunity to withdraw his plea, though the judge afforded him that opportunity. So in light of those three factors, where is the prejudice?
Your Honor, first of all, with respect to whether he requested clemency, unfortunately, the decisions the Army Court and our opposing counsel's brief do not accurately reflect the post-trial submissions. And what I could do is ask if you would please to take a careful look at our post-trial submission, because what we said was that we wanted the period for post-trial submissions told until there was a proper convening authority. And our objection to General Abrams and his SJA was that they were both material witnesses and shouldn't be performing post-trial roles. They were material witnesses because they were engaged in the spoliation of evidence. The court didn't grant review on that. I don't think we asked the court to grant review on that, but that's what the papers reveal. So it wasn't a question of not requesting clemency. We deferred any request for specific clemency because we felt that we needed to have a convening authority who was not disqualified. With respect to whether Sergeant Bergdahl had an opportunity to withdraw his plea, that's not the point. That has to be taken into account in the overall context. And if I can, that's related to the question that I think you also asked. Didn't he get the sentence that he asked for? If you take a careful look at the required colloquy, which appears on pages 2696 and 2697 of the record, the required colloquy makes it clear that his desire was to be discharged from the service with either a BCD or a DD, quote, if, as your counsel indicated, it will preclude you from going to confinement. The trial counsel has sought a shocking 14-year sentence. And it's an understatement for me to say that Sergeant Bergdahl was suffering from deep and justifiable anxiety about any further incarceration following the 5 years that he's already spent in brutal captivity, including the psychological impact of confinement. I think those things have to be taken into account. He certainly, I think that you have to be a little granular about what actually happened during the plea inquiry. Now, the final point, and this is related to your point, Your Honor, maybe not in so many words. One of the factors is there shouldn't be a windfall, and the government has suggested that it would be a windfall for there to be a dismissal with prejudice in this case. There is absolutely no windfall here. As Judge Ewing pointed out at pages 28 and 29, there's no windfall given the recommendations that were made by the Article 32 officer and Major General Dahl, and also the fact that Sergeant Bergdahl had served 5 years in brutal captivity, followed by 6 years in limbo while this case was investigated. investigated and adjudicated. He's effectively lost more than a decade of his life. His nationwide public vilification has indelibly tarred him as a traitor. So the notion that any of this amounts to a windfall if you dismiss with prejudice is, in my opinion, unwarranted.
Mr. Counsel, your time has expired. You will have 5 minutes for rebuttal. Counsel for the government.
Yes, Your Honor. Because you just remember this court and to please the court. I'm Captain Allison Rowley, and I represent the government in this case. This court should affirm the findings and sentence because an
objection. Counsel, could you speak a little closer to the mic?
Yes, Your Honor.
Thank you.
This court should affirm the findings and sentence because an objective, disinterested observer would not harbor a significant doubt about the fairness of appellant's court-martial just because of the comments of President and Senator McCain. This court should be hard-pressed to find apparent UCI where, one, like in Simpson, the comments were neither indirectly nor directly communicated to the convening authority and judges in this case. In fact, neither the convening authority nor the military judge were even aware of the President's Rose Garden comments, and the Army court judge is not aware of the President's April 2019 tweet. Two of the speakers cannot implicitly or explicitly threaten repercussions to the careers of those involved if their views were not adopted, unlike in Boyce. Three, appellant was convicted only of what he pled guilty to and received a sentence that he asked for, a sentence his counsel described as, quote, essential for the preservation of the integrity of the military justice system in light of the President's comments, and that could be found on JA page 512 to 514. Four, any perception that the actions of the convening authority and judges were the result of the comments were dispelled by the fact that these individuals supported their independence and dedication to the fairness of appellant's court-martial through their actions and words. Incredible affirmations that his actions were the result of the exercise of his own independent discretion and that he was and would not be influenced by any outside force. His description of Senator McCain's comments is inappropriate. He stated that he referred the case after extensively reviewing the matters appellant submitted in response to the Article 32, but finding them to be unpersuasive, dispelled any notion that he had stated to be influenced, along with his intent to further protect appellant's court-martial by issuing the order regarding pretrial publicity. As for the military judge and appellate judges in this case, their decisions demonstrate no reason to question the presumption that they were not influenced in their independent duty to do justice. For example, the military judge, rather than accepting the President's campaign comments, described them as, quote, troubling, disappointing, and disturbing, and considered them as mitigation evidence during sentencing. He acquitted appellant of the contested portion of the desertion charge and then spent 7 hours deliberating on a sentence, which was ultimately in accordance with what precisely appellant asked for. The Army Court judges demonstrated their independence by thoroughly addressing appellant's UCI allegations and repeatedly noting inaccuracies in the President's comments. The sentiments and actions of the convening authority and judges demonstrate that there was anything but a perceptible chill over them, and accordingly, this court should find that the comments did not cause an intolerable strain on the public perception of the military justice system.
Thank you, counsel. My question is, this being an apparent UCI case in which one of the criteria is, does it put an intolerable strain on the system of military justice? I ask you, how can the kind of absolutely unprecedented comments made by the President, the Commander-in-Chief, about this case, about the judge, about sentence, about the merits of the case, not put an intolerable strain on the system? The I direct your attention to the amicus brief filed by Mr. Kastenberg, in which they basically say, that basically argue that there ain't no way this can't have that kind of effect, regardless of the personal honesty or demeanor of those actually involved in the court-martial. How can this not put, how can this unprecedented action not put an intolerable strain on the system?
Well, Your Honor, when we're looking at what is the intolerable strain? Well, looking at what is the effect, right? As this court said in Boyce, apparent UCI, it's not about knowledge, it's not about intent, it's all about the effect. And so when we're looking at the effect in this case, we need to look at the referral decision, the findings decision, the sentencing decision, the action decision, and look at each of those and the facts and circumstances.
And I think you look at all that, but it's more than that. It's how the system appears to the knowledgeable public. That's what I'm really asking. I take for granted that the persons involved in the administration of this case did their best and were not, as a matter of fact, influenced. The question is, what does this do to the image of the system? How does this not put an absolutely intolerable strain on it?
Your Honor, I agree with you with your earlier comment that it's the perception of what is the reaction of the military justice system. And when we look at the reaction of the military justice system here, everyone did exactly what they were supposed to do. We have a military judge who exercised his independence and showed his independence by noting, you know, that these comments were disappointing, using those comments to appellant's benefit as evidence in mitigation, offering him the opportunity to withdraw his plea. All of these signs that the individuals in appellant's court-martial are doing everything they can to provide appellant with a fair court-martial, and that is exactly what happened in this case.
Judge Ryan.
Yes, counsel, I have two questions. One, when the military judge adjudicated the first UCI motion, he concluded first that Senator McCain could not commit UCI because he wasn't on active duty, which I think the CTA got that right. But they also seem to suggest that that UCI would be confined to those with command authority. And so that was another reason that they seem to think that Senator McCain could not commit UCI. Do you agree that UCI is confined to only those with command authority?
I do not agree with that.
Okay, thank you. My second question is this, is that, you know, you said that the thing is on effect, right, and a nexus between what is said and a particular court-martial, right? So in this case, Senator McCain and the staff had nonstop discussions with the Army about Senator Bergdahl's case. You would agree with that?
Yes, it appears so from the emails, Your Honor.
Okay. And so why, and this is an actual question, so why would someone in the public not perceive that when Major General Dahl and the preliminary hearing officer both recommended no discharge and no confinement, and at that time the government presented, say I think 132, presented no argument to contradict Major General Dahl's conclusion that no jail time was warranted, why wouldn't an average person in the public believe that that the head of the Senate Armed Services Committee's interest in this case is what resulted in the convening authority sending it to a general court-martial which could adjudge a dishonorable discharge, irrespective of the fact that the person, the convening authority, said it didn't have any impact on him?
Your Honor, so I'd like to address that in two parts. The first is addressing the emails, and then the second addressing the actual referral decision. So when we look at the emails, we see the discussions between the staff OGC and the Army OCLL. And those discussions are merely requests for information. We don't see any pressure there of, any expectation that there is going to be a certain decision. It's mere informational. And the Army is proactively, in response to certain things that Senator McCain has said, you know, making them aware of these are the risks that you are taking. And we are doing everything that we can to protect the integrity of the military justice system. And, you know, if you were to go ahead and hold a hearing, perhaps that line might be crossed. And to note, as far as my knowledge, a hearing was never held, at least during appellant's court-martial. And so we look at that as evidence of the military justice system is doing everything that it can to protect the integrity of appellant's court-martial. With regard to the convening authority's referral decision, that's not a reflection of Senator McCain's desire for or suggestion that there should be confinement. First of all, we have the community authority saying that although he heard the comments, he believed that they were inappropriate, it did not consider them. We also should look at what the maximum punishment was for the offenses, which two investigations found, have reason to believe that appellant committed. And that is a maximum punishment of confinement for life and a dishonorable discharge. In light of that, this referral decision was completely reasonable. And there are no other facts.
Thank you, counsel. Judge Olson.
Good morning, Captain Raleigh.
Good morning, sir.
At the outset of your argument this morning, you essentially stated that because President Trump's and Senator McCain's comments were not personally communicated to the key actors, that there was no harm, no foul. That strikes me as a rather remarkable proposition. What if a commanding general or an incoming commanding general on a post publicly stated to the news media that a soldier who was pending court-martial was a dirty, rotten, no-good traitor? Would there be parents of UCI?
Your Honor, I think as the facts change, circumstances can change, and so certainly what this court is concerned about is that chilling effect by the words that are said. And so when you look at the case here, particularly with regard to the day of sentencing tweet, and did that have a chilling effect on the convening authority and his discretionary exercise under Article 60? And the answer to that is no. First of all,
Mr. Rowley, I'm not quite clear how you're addressing my question to you. My question is, if you have a commanding general or an incoming commanding general who says, not privately to the individual actors, but publicly to the news media, that a soldier pending court-martial is a dirty, rotten, no-good traitor, would there be an appearance of UCI?
Your Honor, there potentially could be. And I think, if we look at former Chief Judge Baker's dissent in Hutchins, right, when we're analyzing this issue of whether these he goes over several factors, and that is, what is the intended audience? What are the words that are said? Are
so
there...
You're referring to a dissent from a judge who's no longer on the court?
Yes, Your Honor.
Okay.
I do believe that that provides helpful guidance, and we can see that when we look at a case like Simpson, where we have senior leaders in the Army, like the Secretary, saying in a class of offenses that there should be no leniency or severe punishment. And so phrases like that, they've been said before, and in Simpson, this court has found that that was not apparent UCI for the reason that those comments were not directly communicated to those involved in the court-martial. And it's hard to believe when we're looking at apparent UCI and we're looking at what is the effect. It's hard to believe that there's going to be effects on the actors in the system if they've never even heard of the word.
Thank you, counsel. Judge Sparks.
Good morning, counsel. How are you?
Good morning, sir.
Good. My question, and I only have one, and it goes to the language we have used in assessing when apparent unlawful influence exists. And we talk about this objective, disinterested observer fully informed of all the facts and circumstances. And so my question is, how broadly are we to consider, quote, fact and circumstance imputed to this disinterested observer? In other words, how much do we assume this disinterested observer knows about military justice, the unlawful command influence doctrine, or jurisprudence, or concerns, or do we view it very, very narrowly, only the specific narrow facts of this case?
Your Honor, my understanding is that it's their knowledge of all the facts and circumstances, not necessarily their knowledge of the apparent UCI test. That is for us to determine from the perspective of that person, of whether the hypothetical person knowing all the facts and circumstances would have a significant doubt, not just a slight doubt, a significant doubt as
what
to the...
other than the facts, are they to consider, in your view?
Your Honor, I think that things that are in the general knowledge, for example, it's general knowledge that judges apply the law. There's a presumption that they are unaffected by outside influences. Those presumptions.
Okay. Thank you. Chief Judge, I have no further questions.
Judge Madge.
Good morning, Captain Riley.
Good morning, sir.
My question is, I'd like to hear the government's specific response to the points that Judge Ewing made in his separate concurrence and partial concurrence and partial dissent, specifically that that a convening authority would have known that the president did not want him to grant any clemency, that he said nothing about this potential problem, and that there's really no possible way to send this back to a different convening authority, and therefore that the remedy should be to get rid of the punitive discharge.
Your Honor, with respect to the convening authority's action, we need to look at the timing of the day in sentencing tweet and the fact that there was 7 months that elapsed. The fact that the tweet was directed at the military judge and the sentence itself, not directed towards the action or the convening authority's exercise of the clemency authority. And I think that those facts, lessen the chilling effect of those comments on the convening authority, in addition to his, repeated incredible affirmations that his actions were his own, in addition to the statement on military justice where the president says, you will exercise your independent discretion, as well as the fact that he considered appellant's matters in which there was no formal request for clemency, and appellant's guilty plea and request for sentence, which is what he got. With respect to the remedy, the government disagrees with Judge Ewing that, if there was an apparent UCI violation in this case, that dismissal that the setting aside of the discharge is appropriate.
Thank you. Okay. Counsel, you have approximately 13 minutes left. You may continue to argue, and judges may interrupt with questions as they see fit.
Can I ask a question just before you get started, counsel?
Yes, Your Honor.
Sure. So a lot of the comments that seem to have been made about Sergeant Bertel referred to him as a traitor and words of that nature. In IO's report, on page 3, he says, he or she says, there is almost unanimous agreement that Sergeant Bertel left OP Med with good, albeit misguided motives. Is that true?
Your Honor, I think that to the extent that that's true, opponent has the opportunity during the sentencing proceedings to lay out factors and extenuation and mitigation for the sentencing authorities to consider, to reduce the sentence. But I also think, important point, with regard to the president calling him a traitor, is that an objective disinterested observer would know that he is not, in fact, charged with treason, that... And so, to the extent that it's political rhetoric, the fact that he's being called a traitor, someone would know that the military judge knows how to apply the law.
Well, let me ask you a different question. And this is, again, for my edification, because I haven't read the entire record of the trial. I wasn't at the trial. So true or false, Sergeant Bertel not only was not charged with being a traitor, he, in fact, was not a traitor. He was a person that left his post without authority.
Your Honor, that's my understanding of the record and the outcome of the investigation, yes.
Thank you.
Counsel, going back to the traitor, if we assume as we used to call it in law school, our reasonable man looking at this whole sequence, I doubt that we assume that the person knows the constitutional requirements for treason. And the point is not, as I think I tried to make in my first question, The point is not whether, in fact, he was charged with treason under the treason statutes, but what effect does this kind of political rhetoric, as you call it, have on the system? I am astonished that we can just breeze by all of this and say, well, it didn't have any effect because everybody involved is an honest, good person, and they all said it didn't have any effect. How can it not bring the system into disrepute?
Your Honor, when we're looking at a current UCI, I think the central question is, knowing the things that have been said, would we have reason to question the exercise of the discretion that the military justice actors have in the system? It's the effect.
Is that too narrow a question? When you're gauging the political viability of the military justice system before the American public in a country that's a democratic republic, also a world power that maintains very large armed forces?
Your Honor, it's the government's position that that's not too narrow. Members of the military, we are supposed to be apolitical when we're conducting our duties. And so to the extent that this is political rhetoric, this is how our system is built, that the president wears many hats. He wears a political hat. He wears the commander-in-chief hat. This is just how our system is built. And the system will crumble if there's no leeway for that, right? Not excusing the fact that words were said, right? And this court has cautioned against that these leaders need to be careful what they say because of their potential effect on the system. But
so what are we to do when these two specific people, like, I'm not talking about, Senator Grassley said something in court, or someone said something about just generally, like, we need to, like, not let crime be rampant in our military, and we're going to come down hard on this. But instead we have two persons that, by virtue of one of them being a retired person, so a person subject to the code under Article 37, and the other one being a convening authority under Article 22 and under one interpretation of RCM 104. So, in fact, they are part of the system.
Your Honor, they are part of the system to the extent that Senator McCain, as chairman of the staff, yes, he does have, as part of the staff legislative authority, the president as commander-in-chief does have certain authority. But I think that appellant's assertion that by the mere position of that authority, any words they speak automatically constitutes UCI because of the things that these people could do, I think that's theoretical pressure. In order for UCI, there can't be speculation. So there's no evidence that, for example, the convening authority was before the staff in nomination. There is no evidence that the convening authority or the military judge or anyone else in this case faced repercussions for their exercise of independent discretion.
But if any of that were true, then we would be looking at actual UCI. Right? If they were facing actual repercussions, or they were being actually pressured one person to another, that would constitute actual UCI. And no one's arguing that there was actual UCI.
Yes, Your Honor.
So, Senator Rowley, this is Judge Olson again. To build a little bit upon this line of questioning, and consistent with your brief, where you say that President Trump and Senator McCain were just engaging in political posturing, so their statements really didn't matter. So in your view, political sword rattling of this nature cannot result in the appearance of UCI?
Your Honor, I think that blanket statement, it's not the assertion the government intended to make. With these facts and these circumstances, it did not constitute an apparent UCI. I agree with the court's caution in past cases, like in Simpson, where those who wear many hats, like political hats, should exercise caution in what they say. But never has this court ever said that those wearing, you know, those in positions, of civilian leadership should never say anything. There's no such blanket rule. But, you know, to the extent that we look at the effect of those statements here on the convening authority, on the military judge, on the judges of the ACCA, there is no question, you know, when we look at their knowledge of the things that were said and the fact that they didn't even know some of these statements were made, there's no reason to question that their integrity was intact when they acted with their independent discretion in appellant's case.
So building on that point for a minute, where you're saying that political people in identified positions should be careful of what they say publicly about a pending court-martial, let's assume just for a minute, and it's just a hypothetical, that this court were to find that, in fact, there was an appearance of unlawful command influence. So then we would have to deal with the appropriate remedy. And your position for the government is that dismissal with prejudice would be a drastic measure. But realistically, if we were to authorize a new court-martial, what are the real-world prospects that there would be no future tweets about this case, which would just plunge us back into the same appearance of UCI ticket that we're wrestling with right now?
Your Honor, certainly there are no guarantees, but when, you know, should this court find apparent UCI, when crafting a remedy, it should look exactly for what appellant asked for in his 1105 matters, and that is that the convening authority should have recused himself, and therefore, you know, it, with that remedy, the remedy here is a new action, should there be apparent UCI that's found. You know, to say that the findings of guilt or the sentence, including the dishonorable discharge, should be set aside, I think that wouldn't foster confidence in the system, given that appellant has asked for those things.
So let me look
and that's a windfall.
Different point in time. We're talking about the point in time of what the military judge did, what the convening authority did post-trial, etc. What about the convening authority's decision to refer this to a general court-martial where a dishonorable discharge could be adjudged, whereas what was recommended by two people that had a lot of involvement with the facts and the cases of the Article 32 recommended a different disposition? So what if we were to find that the average person in the public, aware of the status importance, aware of Senator McCain's influence, aware of his expressed interest in the case, and his expressed displeasure of the notion of no punishment being given, if I believe he calls him a traitor, maybe he does call him a deserter, that but for those things, that they would be concerned that he would not have been sent to a trial where he could get a dishonorable discharge to begin with.
No, I think that requires a closer look at the Article 32 IO's report and the reason why he made that disposition. Recommendation, and that is because of the mitigation evidence that was presented at the 32, along with the fact that the evidence didn't present evidence of casualties. And I think that those two facts were facts that are presented to a sentencing.
But what do we make of the fact that the government expressly chose not to put on evidence of casualties, even though the military judge, the IO, had questions about such things, and they just basically decided not to do that?
Your Honor, I can't speak for the government in why they made that decision, but those are things that a sentencing authority could consider. And when we're looking at that disposition, that referral decision, even if this case were referred to a special court martial not authorized to, a discharge, appellant still would have faced some sort of punishment. And ultimately, that is up to the sentencing authority. The convening authority is not the one who determined the punishment. Although, you know, certainly the referral decision can play a part in that. But ultimately, when we look at the maximum punishment for the offense is confinement for life and a dishonorable discharge, certainly that in and of itself, doesn't leave any question, for the referral decision in this case, along with what the convening authority's testimony that he found those statements by Senator McCain to be inappropriate.
Other questions? Counsel, have you completed your argument?
Yes, Your Honor.
Thank you very much. Mr. Fidel, you have 5 minutes for rebuttal.
Thank you, Chief Justice. There are only 2 points I want to make. The first is that the highest value about which this court has to be concerned is public confidence in the administration of justice. Without public confidence, everybody involved in the administration of military justice will have been wasting our time. The second point is that whatever remedy the court fashions for the unlawful influence demonstrated on the record of this case, it must be a remedy that will achieve a deterrent effect. This must never be permitted to happen again. It might happen again, but if it happens again, the perpetrators of the UCI at that time will have to know that they will be deprived of the political benefit, the ill-gotten gains of their efforts to meddle in the administration of justice. Thank you very much. If the court has no further questions, we rest.
Any judge have any questions for Mr. Fidel? If not, thank you. The court thanks counsel for both sides. The case is now submitted, and the court is in recess until 09:30 tomorrow. Thank you.